I want to introduce our third speaker, who is Jennifer from Sonoma. Come on down, Jennifer. Now we're going to put this so that you can... Is that going to be okay? How's that?
Looks good.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Jennifer, compulsive overeater and bulimic. Hi. And I'm really grateful to be here. And I did not study comparative religion. However, when I was a young girl, I dragged my poor father to church every Sunday because I discovered that they had free donuts. And, you know, it's so funny, I have no recollection of God or anything else of any religious nature. All I remember were, you know, glazed. Everything glazed. And then also I got to wear a pretty purple robe and sing in the choir. So I am extremely grateful to be abstinent today. I feel like I should be sharing with the attitude of gratitude. Just going to make a pitch for this right now, even though it's not my county. Looks like a good one. And I may jump around a little bit. I'm very nervous, but like somebody else said, oftentimes before I speak, I just have to sort of pause and ask, ask to be of service and ask to be sort of a messenger of higher power. Oftentimes I think to myself, well, I don't have anything good to say. I don't have, my recovery is not good enough. I don't do enough. I don't use the tools enough. And I mean, I'm abstinent today. That's enough. I have some experience, strength, and hope. And just to give you some statistics, I have been in the program for about 11 years. I currently have a little over 7 years of abstinence from binging and purging. I'm maintaining like a 45-50 pound weight loss. And I was not one of those bulimics that could eat and pull it off. I ate so much that it didn't all come up. So, and parts of my story are sort of gruesome, and oftentimes I share these parts of my story that are pretty disgusting, and I'm afraid that I am, and you guys are eating lunch, so beware. I won't get too graphic, but I mean, it was hell. It was utter hell. And the things that I did, I'm not ashamed of today, but I mean, yeah. It's really sad, the things that I did to my body. And I certainly, you know, to this day, even though I have 7 years of abstinence, I think I probably did permanent damage to my immune system and other parts of my body. And I think that's just true for any compulsive overeater. I mean, it's, can't think of the word, but disfiguration or just, you know, maiming our bodies. And I certainly did that, and I used laxatives, and I vomited, and I used forks down my throat, and all sorts of hideous things. So I feel like I'm a miracle. at some point, I felt like I was incomprehensible. I was constitutionally incapable of being abstinent. I really did, and I did not understand how people were able to not eat, even when it felt like that was the only solution. To me, especially when I was in my relapse in this program, didn't know if I was ever going to make it. And for me, it's a fatal and progressive disease, and it led me to suicidal desperation. I did not know how to stop, and so life was just not worth living anymore. I mean, it was miserable. It was, I'll sort of go into my story a little bit more, but I want to talk about abstinence through the holidays, and it's a great topic, and I don't know if I have that much to say about it, but You know, when I remember my first couple years in my second abstinence, and when I got abstinent again, I was just so desperate. I was willing to do anything anyone ever told me. So I started weighing and measuring my food, and I still do it to this day. And it's just, for me, it's sanity. Like, I just have these parameters. I don't have to think about if I ate too much or too little. And, you know, there it is. There's my food, and it's plentiful. And I also go out and I eat at restaurants, and I'll, you know, if I'm invited to a dinner party, and I don't weigh and measure, but I feel like, you know, but certainly in those first couple years, I was really scared of food, and it just worked. And that's what I had to do. But I remember going home for Thanksgiving, and it's funny, you know, Thanksgiving, it's like, so we have the protein, vegetables, and carbs, you know, like you can easily make a well-balanced meal. But I was eating these frozen vegetables, you know, and only eating like a certain kind of fish or something like that. And, it's, you know, here's this like beautiful spread, you know, I could have brought my scale, weighed out turkey and vegetables, but instead I had my frozen veggies and my frozen salmon. And I was so happy, you know, I was just like, oh, I'm okay. And I've heard this so many times that there's another word for Thanksgiving, and it's Thursday. You know, it's just another effing day. Like, that's all it is. And I think just sort of setting the intention of living in gratitude that day, or being of service to whomever you're spending time with on that day or any other holiday, that has really worked for me. And also getting to meetings, like going to the thankathons, those have been extremely helpful, and the turnout is just amazing. And there are always great speakers, and I usually go down to L.A., because that's where I'm originally from. And so I'll go to their, you know, thankathons or their whatever they have for the holidays. And they're usually like these marathon meetings, and they're just great. So, and I go, you know, even if family's over, and I think I'm really lucky, because I've heard people talk about going home to family. And, you know, how crazy some of our families are. And of course they're the reason why we're compulsive overeaters. So I don't blame my family. But you know, even when there's family there and there are certain, you know, obligations that you have as a family member, my abstinence is the most important thing in my life without exception. And so I don't care what other people think. It's my ass. It's like, you can't save your face and your ass at the same time. So I prefer to save my ass. And excuse me, I am kind of, I got a trucker's, you know, mouth. So I'll try and keep it pretty clean. Yeah, and you know, what's really helped too, if you're away from family or however you celebrate the holidays, celebrating with other people in the fellowship. And that's been great, because I've been up in the Bay Area for 15 years, and so, you know, with my job, whatever sort of job I have, I usually can't get down for both holidays. So it's been sort of a tradition, or it was a tradition when I was living in Oakland, that we all went to, you know, like a Chinese restaurant or something like that, and went to a movie. Or the thankathon first, everyone met up, and so it was just really nice to sort of spend time with family, because I feel like I am home when I'm in these meetings, and there's just sort of unconditional love and support in these rooms. And it's this is the first place that I learned to trust other people, because my ability to trust, even to this day, is not the strongest, or however you say that. So now I'm going to segue into what it was like. I want to give you a little history, and then kind of tell you how I got in the program and what it's like now. And I'll try to weave in some holiday stuff. So I grew up in Los Angeles, and I was a fairly normal sized kid when I, you know, up until about the age of 11. My mom, tall, thin, beautiful, and never once talked about dieting or anything like that. And she was European, and she would have a glass of wine at night and her cigarette, and, you know, and she would eat normal meals, and so that was not unusual. My dad, athletic, and also just healthy, and then my sister, and then there was me, who, when my grandmother from Germany would send my sister and I lots of candy for Christmas, my sister would be able, you know, we had like, each had like 5 bars of chocolate, and my sister would eat 1 square at a time. And, you know, I'd eat 1 square, and then I'd go back and eat the next square, and the next square, and the next square, and pretty soon the whole bar is gone in like an hour, and then I eat the next bar, and then I'm stealing my sister's, you know, and she doesn't even notice. I'm like, what's wrong with you? Like, you know, there's all this stuff in the refrigerator. You can just, like, devour it. And so, yeah, somehow, and nobody in my family, well, I have an aunt and an uncle who are recovering alcoholics, but nobody in my immediate family with any sort of, like, really obvious manifestation of this disease. However, not a perfect unit by any stretch of the imagination, and, I mean, they, you know, I was well taken care of. I had all my needs met, but the emotional piece was missing, definitely, and just sort of the attachment that children have to their parents. And I felt very detached from my family and felt very much like I was sort of the outsider looking in. But I think everybody in my family sort of felt like that way. It's sort of when you, I don't know if you watch Sesame Street and everyone's sort of doing something in the house, you know. I don't know. Like, you know, somebody's doing that in this room. And so, like, all these separate little compartments. And so it didn't feel like a very tight unit. And, you know, one of the rules in my house was, it was sort of an unspoken rule, was look good. You know, feelings weren't acceptable. Put a smile on your face. Look beautiful. You know, my mom, just stunning woman, and so that was sort of the unspoken rule. And when I started to gain weight, it was certainly an issue for my parents, but they never, you know, bribed me with, you know, a new wardrobe if I lost weight or anything like that. It was really actually, my parents didn't pay much attention to me. It was sort of, again, like everyone just sort of off in their own little world. And so, so in some ways, you know, I could not get away with a lot of stuff, but just anything that was obviously unhealthy or a sign of trouble was not spoken about or was not mentioned. I learned to use food as my comfort, as many of you may have also experienced. Food was just easy. Food was there. Food was reliable. I could just, you know, I knew exactly what effect I was going to get from the food, especially sugar. That was certainly my drug of choice. And I, you know, I around 10 or 11, that's when I started to really gain weight and started to eat in isolation. It became... I became much more ashamed of my eating, and that's when you could see it on my body physically. I was never like more than 15 pounds overweight. It's just, you know, it's so funny. Like, the disease is just between my two ears. It's my head. And growing up, I don't know if it was just growing up in LA, but I think especially for just teenage girls, I mean, oh, God, I do not want to go back there. I mean, it was just painful. And just comparing and, you know, standard of beauty that was just completely unreachable. And then I my guess is that growing up in Los Angeles, it was a little more exaggerated. So, but yeah, I just started eating and started to do it in secret. I mean, my favorite thing in high school was to check out, you know, or sign out from school, because you could do that. I always said I had cramps, but I had my period like all month long. So, you know, I could sign out. I could go through, you know, the fast food drive through, get the biggie of whatever, and go get my sugar. It's like crack. Go and get, you know, going down to the corner store to get my crack, rent a movie, or sit in front of the TV and watch soap operas and just achieve oblivion. I was just didn't want to feel, and you know, I was not conscious. I was not even aware that like my problems were not my weight. Like I thought the problem was that I was fat. I thought that was my only problem. I wasn't even conscious enough to think that, well, huh, maybe the relationship I have with my parents isn't all that great. Maybe I have low self-esteem. It was just like, I'm fat and I need to lose the weight. And I tried several times to lose weight, but I was such an unsuccessful dieter. I could never do it. I could never stay on a fast or one of the, you know, thousands of diets that I found in magazines, or I even went to a weight loss camp once, and I was probably the smallest girl there, which is, you know, pretty sad. Went there and was able to sort of maintain this really low weight, and can go into the anorexia as well, but you know, came back, and shortly after, about a month after, I just started binging my brains out again. And I would do things like steal my dad's credit card so I could go down to the new, some place where they, you know, guarantee that you would lose 5 pounds when, after they wrapped you up in this like hot herbal ace bandage, you know, and it would just melt away the pounds. I mean, I was just, I wanted, there was nothing more I wanted than to be thin. Really stunted my growth, really stunted my emotional growth, my all development, my emotional, my spiritual development, my intellectual development. And it's so funny because I hear so many speakers talk about how they just thought it was like they got the program, that they were too smart for this program. But when I first walked in, I thought I was too dumb. I really thought that somehow I was intellectually inferior to everyone else, and that you needed to be semi-intelligent to work this program. But I guess not. And I have a master's degree now, and that's all due to this program. It's absolutely, and the field that I'm in and why I wanted to go back to school and get a master's degree is because of my experience of doing service. So I'm a social worker now, and I can't imagine doing any other type of work than being of service. So, and it's more than that. But let's see, where was I? Can't remember. So it's like, let's see what Paul says. Action. Okay. Let's see. Where was I in my disease? Action. So it just stunted my, you know, development. And even though it appeared from the outside that I had lots of friends, and, you know, it was really easy actually for me to be social, is because I found drugs and alcohol too. You get me to a party, get me loaded, hook up with any guy who was remotely interested in me, and you know, I could have a good time. So certainly drugs and alcohol are a part of my story, but I actually never went to any other programs. And when I got here, I knew that I couldn't. Actually, that's not true. Not when I first got here, but when I got abstinent again, I knew I had to stop drinking. Because when I got abstinent for the first 2 years of program, I started drinking quite a bit. And I think that contributed somewhat to my relapse. So, I mean, I just remember going to a party. Yeah, that's when I first picked up the food. after those 2 years, and I was drinking a lot, and there was just this really amazing spread, and all of a sudden, like, the disease kicked in, and I was just in the bathroom binging my brains out on all these things that people had brought for this potluck. So it's pretty scary. So the disease is definitely doing push-ups and will always be doing push-ups, and I just need to be vigilant about... Oh, great, 20 minutes. So let me kind of tell you what happened. And then I started, you know, started using laxatives and then started vomiting. And it's just, like, when I first vomited, it was just, can't imagine, I was in paradise. It was in Bali, of all places. And my friend and I were traveling, and we had this sort of unspoken competition going on who could lose the most weight, because she told me before we went that it was so hot that you never wanted to eat. And I was like, you're right. So, and this sort of just illustrates what an addict I am. So we got there, and actually it's true, we didn't eat, but we lived off of heroin and beer and pineapple. So, great diet. High the whole time, I loved it. And then we went out to a restaurant and both ordered like 2 entrees each, ate them. You know, our stomachs were so small, and she purged and then I purged, and that was sort of the beginning of my bulimia. Well, the laxative sort of was the beginning of that, but the vomiting part. And so how I got here was through a therapist, and I feel like it was just sort of higher power working through her. She suggested that I go to OA, and my first thought was, oh, hello, a bunch of freaks, you know, and like, I was the freak because I was sticking a fork down my throat, you know, after I had just consumed, you know, a bag of this, a box of that, and a carton, and a gallon of that. I think, you know, I was terrified. I was terrified to be transparent. I was terrified to tell anyone that I had a problem. I was terrified to come into these rooms because I just didn't know what I would say, if I even had to say anything. So, but, you know, after just sort of working with her for a while and it just getting worse and worse and worse, I mean, I just remember, you know, going to work, you know, sort of committing that I wasn't going to eat that day, start to eat, and then, you know, and I can't leave work, so I go home and I'm living with a roommate, and so instead of vomiting in the toilet, instead of that, because I'd have to clean that up, I'd just do it in a big, like, plastic bag, and I just kind of kept that plastic bag. You know, that was my life. Like, it was eating, it was, like, that big. It was miserable. And so, finally, I was so desperate that I did go to a meeting, and I was mortified. I walked in late, left early, and I cried the whole time. And people were talking about doing things with food that I had done with food, and I thought I was the only person on earth that had done these things with food. And these were women like in their 40s and 50s, and I was 25, and you know, no one, I couldn't relate to anyone, but I could relate to everyone, you know. And they were talking about just the disease of the mind, the disease thinking, and I, even though it was so painful to be there and I was so terrified, I knew that I had to go back. I mean, I just had nowhere else to go. I did not know what I was going to do. And I really, you know, I was feeling pretty suicidal and didn't know how I was going to stop. And so here I am 11 years later. you know, I always say that, like, I've never actually done any, like, I've never stuck with anything. And perfect example, I just threw down $300 for salsa boot camp, you know, and I've been to like half of the classes, you know. But OA, and I've also had periods where I've just wanted to walk out, you know, I don't want to do this anymore, I want to be a normal person, I don't want to have to go to these meetings, blah, 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 blah. But I just keep getting pulled back in because there's no other place for me to go. There's no other place for me to hear people talk about their lives and the sort of struggles and the challenges and staying abstinent. And then also hearing newcomers and being reminded of just the devastating effects of this disease. So, still here, 11 years later. And when I got here again in 96, I did anything anyone told me to do. I was just that willing. I was sort of on my hands and knees and feared God. You know, God's an acronym for a gift of desperation. So I got a sponsor right away. And again, just to sort of, I mean, I was just at my lowest point. I did not think I was worthy enough to have even a sponsor. And so I remember sharing that at a meeting, and I can't even believe that I shared at a meeting because I would just sort of sit in the back and tremble because I was just so scared that someone was actually going to talk to me. And I'm always amazed when newcomers come to their first meeting and they speak. I'm like, how do they do that? You know, wow, that's so great. And but she volunteered to be my sponsor, and we started working the steps, and I called her every morning at 7 a.m., and I committed my food to her every morning, and I ate that food. And I'm really grateful that that individuals are allowed to pick their own food plans, because when I first walked in and you told me that I had to weigh and measure and carry Tupperware, I would have been out the door. It's like, oh, Tupperware's for, like, nerds, you know? Like, how lame. But I have a funny story about that, because when I was actually in my abstinence this time around, I was working at a group home for kids, and at 12 o'clock, it was like just clockwork, 12 o'clock, I'd go into the staff kitchen, and they could see the staff kitchen, and I would be in there for about, I don't know, 2-3 minutes, and I'd come out with my Tupperware. And so once there was a staff party, and they were giving away awards, like, you know, most likely to calm a kid down, or most, you know, whatever, and I got most likely to bring her own lunch. I was like, that's right, and I've asked it, and all you are eating crap. you know, and I still do that. I have my Tupperware with me today, and I'm grateful that I have the willingness, and it's all grace. It's all just grace. Like, I never thought that I would be doing the things that I do today for my recovery, and so just to go back, so I started, you know, doing things that people told me to do, and I started going to meetings, and I became a sponsor, and I also took service positions, which were really important, because I could have easily just sort of sat on the sidelines and not participated at all, but service allowed me to feel like I was contributing something to the meeting, even when I was too scared to sort of raise my hand and share about anything. So that was really important for me to do service. And my relapse was a blessing in disguise, and I just want to say for anybody who's struggling, keep coming back. Don't leave before the miracle happens. Do not leave. And so I relapsed. I was in relapse for a year and a half, but I never left the rooms. I mean, I just remember, like, just being in the bathroom on the fifth floor of the hospital, vomiting, and then going to the 12th floor to the meeting, you know, like, I don't know what else to do, but I could not stop. And so I just kept coming to meetings, and there were people in these rooms that, I felt like those people were, you know, channeling my higher power. And they just, you know, they kept saying, you belong here. You know, the third tradition states that the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop eating compulsively. It doesn't mean you have to be stopped. It's just a desire. And I'm so grateful for that today, because I really did think it was a moral issue. I really thought that I was just that something, I was just defective. And I really got step one. And, you know, my first 2 years, I think I was just scared. I was just so scared and willing to do anything that I worked through the steps, but my relationship with a higher power was non-existent for the most part those first 2 years. And what I learned in relapse was that if I take that first bite, I have no idea where that's going to lead me. I have no clue. And that, prime example is, you know, I would be maybe abstinent for a little while, and then all of a sudden I just felt this overwhelming need to just binge, because it was just felt intolerable. Like I could not just be in my skin. And so I would always plan a binge and say, well, this is going to be the last one. This will be the last time I'm going to do this. And I even went so far as to go to Ben and Jerry's, and I got an ice cream cake, and I had them write on there, get well soon. And what did I do? I ate the whole thing, threw it up, and went back out. It was miserable. So I finally got it that I was not in control, that there was no way that I could, you know, that I could do this on my own. And so I finally conceded to my innermost self that I had this disease, that I couldn't do it without the help of a higher power. And I have to say, though, getting back on track and getting abstinent again required me to do things that I didn't think I would have to do. I quit my job. I went to 3 meetings a day. I saw someone in OA, like, face-to-face every day. I called my sponsor every day. I weighed and measured my food. I saw my therapist every day. I mean, I just, like, basically I created my own treatment program because really I wanted to be locked up. I just did not know how I was going to stop unless I was, like, in a padded cell and someone, you know, put a tray under the door. And I was willing. I was finally willing. And I've heard this before, is that, you know, for a long time when I was in relapse, the pain of not eating was greater than the pain of eating. And then suddenly it just switched, and it was the pain of eating was greater than the pain of not eating. And I still to this day, I have to act as if. I do a lot of acting as if, and I really am envious, even though I should be working on that, of people who have a really just, you know, that they have a solid relationship with a higher power and that they really believe. And I would love to be there, but I'm not always there. I still, to this day, have a hard time with that, but that's okay. You don't have to be in this program and be completely, absolutely convinced. At least I don't think so. I mean, I think I'm sort of, an example of that is I know that there's something. There's got to be something. And it's almost sort of, again, in an act of desperation, like, I have no idea if there's anything that's going to help me with this, but I'm just going to give it to whatever. I'm just going to turn it over, and I'm just going to, no matter what, I'm not going to eat. I don't care if I do anything else. I mean, that's just like, no matter what, I don't eat. And I'm working on that, and I'm working on step two. And that's just something that I think I'll always be working on, because in my house there was no mention of anything spiritual whatsoever. Again, like I said, I went to church for the donut. So, and it was, for some reason, it was, and it continued to be somewhat difficult for me to believe that there is something that is, I don't know, putting things in place or sort of orchestrating the whole thing. Sometimes I feel like a lot of stuff is just random, but that's life for me at least. And again, even though sometimes I struggle with the, you know, with the higher power thing, I just, what I do know what to do is to go to meetings. I know to be of service. When I got abstinent again, I just threw myself into service again. I took as many service positions that I could possibly find. So I had a commitment at all sorts of meetings. And I, you know, I know to sponsor. That's an important one for me. And writing certainly helps, and praying certainly helps. And, you know, again, just 5 minutes left. Thanks. I feel like I'm rambling, but, and, you know, I guess I just to admit, on a level, I have some shame, and that's something I have to work through, shame that I, you know, still don't believe entirely. But I think it's this step two is coming to believe. It doesn't say came to believe. And I have some hope. I have faith. I know this program works. And I know that without this program, my life would be pretty, like, I would not have the things that I have in my life today if it weren't for this program. And I really owe this program my life. It saved my life. It saved my life. And so, you know, this holiday season, I get to, hopefully God willing, or whatever willing, I get to, you know, go home and be of service to my family, be of service to other folks down there, and I get to be in gratitude. Like, that's just, that gratitude and hope. I realized one day in a meeting that those two words were never, ever a part of my vocabulary. It just kind of occurred to me. I never remember, like, saying the word gratitude before I got here. And now I am filled with gratitude. Most days, even when it's a really hard day, I can, you know, I can just say, there but for the grace of God go I. When, you know, other folks talk about how difficult, like, if, you know, what if someone's in relapse, or if, you know, there's somebody that I know that's not in the program that certainly has this disease. So I feel like I'm rambling, so I'm actually going to give you all sorts of time to share, because I really, for me, what I get most out of meetings is hearing people talk about their recovery and their hope and their relationship with a higher power, and then I get all these great ideas. And the one that doesn't work for me yet, though, is higher power, like, being a doorknob. I've heard that one. I'm like, how does that work? So I guess, you know, sort of metaphoric, like, you're opening up, you know, the door and letting some light in, and that's a higher power. So I'm just grateful that you all come here, and I feel like you guys saved my life, because if it weren't for meetings, I probably wouldn't be here today. And so you make my recovery possible. And it's, you know, when you're thinking about not going to a meeting, think about me. Not like I'm, you know, the most important person in the world, but, you know. So, thank you so much, and I hope you have a beautiful abstinent day.
Thank you, Jennifer.